Blog Talk Radio.
The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hills, for the caged bird sings of freedom. Floats downstream till the currents heat, and dips his wing in the orange sun rays, and dares to claim the sky. Seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are thin. lips, his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. Fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. For the caged bird sings of freedom.
A yaka ka, a yaku ku. Now, if those aren't some lyrics, I don't know what are. Of course, that bumper tune was the late great Maya Angelou in concert with the great Wynton Marsalis doing that special piece, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. One of my favorites. And I thought, apropos for today, well, this evening's program. And by the way, welcome to another edition of Progressive News Weekly. My name is Darrell Clark, and you are at the right place at the right time. Here at Progressive News Weekly, for those of you who are our regular listeners, you know, week in and week out, we bring you news and information that's, well, cold, as I like to say, gathered from around the country. And today, this evening, is no exception. I'm especially pleased with this evening's program, not just because of the content, but because of the deliverer of this message, someone very special to me. So before we go there, I just want to say again, thank you for those of you who have listened for these 9+ years repeatedly, consistently. We truly appreciate your patronage and your support. We bring you this news and information intended to encourage you and inspire you, enlighten you, naturally to empower you, as important as anything to inspire you and encourage you to get involved and make a difference. It's not just talking heads. It's active radio. It's news you can use, as we like to say, and it's also news that's for you, by you, and of you. Words similar to our Constitution. Though there are many that would say, we don't always live up to those words. Well, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else myself. And yet I do know there is work to be done. And that's where we come in. We, that being you and I, and others like us, of like minds, of progressive minds, of minds that truly want to make a difference for the better. And so I encourage you and I ask you continually, if you know of a topic or guest that would fit that bill, that would enlighten beyond the norm, beyond what is typically heard on mainstream media, or if it's heard or that individual may have appeared on mainstream, it or they or and or they are not given the attention or time they deserve. And those topics or individuals may be faced with a spin one way or the other, either through political or business and or interest. We don't do that here on Progressive News Weekly. It's unadulterated. It's live. It's real. It's vetted, so you'll never get information here that we haven't done some type of background investigation on to see if it's making any kind of sense at all. We encourage you to follow up on anything that you've heard here and share with us what you find. So with that said, there's lots of things going on in the media, mainstream. By many standards, you would think that our government is dibbling and dabbling with another major skirmish overseas. You can see that there have been some improvements in terms of the foods that we see brought before us. As I am in the supermarkets, like most of us at one time or another, and I see the shelves stocked as always, but I see more and more labeling of non-GMO, genetically modified organisms, no high fructose corn syrup. So I'm seeing some improvements, and those improvements didn't come by chance. They didn't come because these manufacturers just decided, well, let's stop cutting corners. Let's give them something that's a little better. No, it came about because of you and I speaking out. We're seeing more about the potential dangers of vaccines. Those things just didn't happen. It happened because those people who and businesses who are responsible were being held accountable. And so we must continue vigilantly to do that for our own interest. If you tuned in last week, you had a special treat with our own Deborah Dow. You can catch it in the archives. She did a special 2-week segment. So the last 2 weeks you will have heard her, and just talking about self-sufficiency and the lack thereof over the last many decades, how our society has become so dangerously vulnerable, and how there was a time when if you didn't have a fruit tree, if you had any property at all, and even if you were renting, there was usually some type of a fruit tree or a garden somewhere around, and we don't see much of that. So we need to move back into that direction as we become direly vulnerable. So with this being Earth Month and Earth Week coming up quickly, we'll be talking more about that. For our special guest tonight, I had a conversation, and he and I go back. So there's a hint. It is a he, for those of you not on the mail list. We go back, actually, over a decade. And our common thread was one of benevolence, one of wanting to make a difference, and that's how we met. From time to time, we would come back together, and he's been here on these airwaves before. And I'm so proud that he's been very busy carrying forth his personal journey and mission to make a difference. And from time to time, he'd keep me posted, and I'd spread that good news. And I'd say, you know, when you get settled a little bit, you know, you're going to have to come back and join us in Progressive News. So we had a conversation. It's been a month or so. And he said, Daryl, we're going to make it happen. And that's why I'm especially pleased. And we're not going to let that much time go by, I'm hoping. But if he continues on that journey, we'll have to probably catch him on the road, because he is moving and shaking, and he is making a difference. And we're going to support him in that. And the individual that I'm talking about is named Lederick Horn. If you are not on my mail list, you'll want to get on the mail list, because you would have known that. Mr. Horn is truly an advocate for human and civil rights, and more specifically, he's thrown a gauntlet, and he stood by it, and he's made a decision that he is going to be an advocate, especially for those with disabilities. And so we're going to get into some of that conversation. And one thing that I know Mr. Horn for, going way back, is his talents as an artist of the spoken word. And hopefully he'll share with us at least one treat thereof this evening. I've already extended the program in case we have some you know, questions or comments, or Derek has some special information he wants to share with us if we need to extend the program for a little bit this evening. We'll make amends for that. But otherwise, we'll be wrapping up at the bottom of the hour. So hold on to your seat belts, folks, because this is truly going to be a treat. And from time to time, I do have a comrade or a colleague, friend, family member, and someone that, with all of that, is still a remarkable mind. And it just truly does me well. So I'm treating myself this Easter week with a special treat, a special guest in Mr. Lederick Horn. So just to give you a little bit of background on Mr. Horn, he's an artist of the spoken word. He's an advocate, as I mentioned, for those with disabilities. He's truly a humanitarian. He's widely recognized for his body of work of the spoken word, a poet. He has used his gift to serve as a gateway to help bring about equal opportunity, pride, self-determination, and hope for people specifically with disabilities. He's also outspoken, though, for human rights, and speaks freely on issues affecting all those who are disenfranchised. And for this purpose, he regularly addresses an array of academic, government, social, and business groups nationally. He's spoken at the United Nations, colleges from across the country, including Harvard. He's even spoken at the White House. He's the co-author of Empowering Students with Hidden Disabilities, A Path to Pride and Success. We'll talk a little bit about that in the interview. He's also the co-creator of New Street Poets, a spoken word play about the effects of gentrification, gentrification on urban culture. This was a play that has been met with rave reviews, and it's actually toured nationally. So this evening, we're going to go beyond some of the accolades and get a little bit into Mr. Horn, the Horn that I know. So a little play on words. We're going to toot the horn of Mr. Horn, because he's usually not that type of a person. But you need to know this individual, because you're going to hear a lot more about him. And once you understand him, you're going to want to know more. So without further ado, the next voice you'll hear will be that of Mr. Lederick Horn. Mr. Horn, welcome to another edition of Progressive News Weekly.
Daryl, how are you? Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. You know, it's been a while.
Yes.
But you haven't let any moss grow under your feet. You've been a busy, busy guy.
Yes, sir. The past couple of years have been very busy and good to me as well.
Yeah. You know, let me back up a bit. I want to give the listeners just a little bit of an idea of who you are. You know, when we came together, it was on, it's been about 15 years or so. It was on, a benevolent journey. I think we were working with children. I was working with corporate at the time, and you were working with a good common colleague, you know, who I'm talking about, Mr. Bill.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And he may be listening in, because I made sure he was aware of this. Your guest appearance, and you know, from there it was, the rest is, as they say, history in terms of our common thread, our common interest for making a difference. And so since then, I see you have not stopped. You at that point you were more focused on the spoken word, and since then you've taken that gift and utilized it for a specific purpose of making a difference other than just entertainment. When did you make that determination that's what you were going to do, Lederick?
You know, it's it's interesting that you're mentioning that time, because if memory serves me correctly, it was actually a bit longer than 15 years ago, and I believe I was a college student when we met each other. So I was, yeah, I was, I was a bit old for a college student, I guess your average college student, but nevertheless, I was towards the end of my degree, and I actually studied mathematics. I realized I was very good at math once I finally got to college, and also realized I was good at writing, and so pursued poetry as more of a passion. But my academic studies was around math, so I was a math tutor for the program called EPIC, which was a weekend tutoring program. And then, and I was also writing poetry and performing poetry in New Jersey. At one point, I was involved in running three different open mics in central New Jersey when I was a student. And I just really loved the scene, loved connecting with different artists. And this was also a time when slam poetry was becoming very, very popular. So when I was a kid, I really credit my parents are sort of introducing me to poetry. My mother had a copy of the very first, an original copy of the first Slack Poets album, and would play it for me when I was a kid. And so we also had know, Gil Scott-Heron and stuff like that, you know, artists of that caliber playing when I was a very, really, really, really young kid. And so I grew up with this sort of idea that art in general, but poetry in particular, really should be in service of people. And I love the open mics. I love the open mic scene. I love the honesty of it. But the sort of competition stuff was becoming very, very popular. And I don't know if it's, you know, maybe my ego or what, but I just was not that kind of artist. I just didn't feel comfortable in that sort of scene. And so kind of towards the end of my time in college, I actually pulled away from performing very much. I would still write, but I wasn't, I wasn't actively seeking out a stage. Beyond these weekend tutoring programs, you know, where you and I connected with each other, where I was a resident math tutor as well as the resident poet. And so I had an opportunity to sort of perform whatever I was working on with the young people that would come to those meetings. I remember I got my degree from New Jersey City University, and the director of student affairs there asked me if I would be interested in featuring. And I said, you know, I hadn't performed in quite a while, but I put together a set, and that went really, really well. And then shortly after graduating, the New Jersey Department of Education's Office of Special Education scooped me up and asked me if I would be interested in doing some youth leadership and development work, part of a series of conferences we do here in the state of New Jersey for young people with disabilities, young people who are in special education. And it suddenly sort of occurred to me that, you know, this was a way that I could take, all the skills that I had developed both as a writer and as a performer, and use that work to be progressive, to be a force for change, but to funnel it very, very precisely to a population of young people who had disabilities, who, you know, I didn't really see a lot of, particularly at the time, a lot of poetry that was being created for them directly. And so, that's when the light bulb sort of came on for me, and I decided to become a poet. And, you know, when I meet young artists, one of the things that I tell them is that you should really try to have a place and a people that you represent with your work. And so I decided to really represent young people who had gone through special education, people with disabilities.
Wow. I love that advice you give, because what you said have a place and a and a people that you'll represent. What you've said with that is something we don't see too often as much as we did, and you'll relate to this through the wisdom that you've shared, that you received from your parents. When I hear black poets, or the last poets, black poets, Gil Scott-Heron, I know you have that wisdom to be able to pick that up from them, and I experienced it to some extent myself. There was a time when you were an entertainer or an artist, it wasn't the exception that you were engaged. It was the norm.
Right.
And we don't see that now. Now it's about, you know, the almighty dead presidents.
Right.
And that's the end of it. And I think our society has suffered significantly behind it, especially when you take into consideration social media. Because yeah. I would say that today, entertainers have an exponentially greater influence on society than it did even 20 years ago, not to mention 40 years ago. When you start talking about the internet and the advent of the cell phone and Facebook and Twitter, and so when you start looking at those things, but as inroads to the eye, the ear, the mind, yet those social ills, they continue if you don't have that counterbalance, then I would dare say that I'm looking at it from that perspective as I speak with you. I'm surprised that we aren't worse off as a society than we are, because these social ills that we're talking about now, I mean, they're somewhat different, but basically there'll always be people that are doing things that are illicit, you know, perverted, illegal, whatever other words you'd like to use to describe that, which is a degradation to the morals of society. Those things didn't just start 10, 5, last year, or even 20 years ago. But we had those individuals that had a moral consciousness to at least put some counterbalance in that. And now our whole government is infiltrated with this illness, and yet there's not that same level of counterbalance. And the interesting part about that is, with this capability that we have, if more had a social consciousness to use that strong electronic capability to counterbalance, I dare say we'd be a whole heck of a lot better as a society. So I just want to take a moment to take my hat off to say kudos, you know, sending that message, because, you know, relatively speaking, as a artist that's young, so to speak, you know, you have a voice that can make a difference. So I just want to encourage you to, you know, continue with what you're doing and that approach that you are taking to say, I wish to make a difference. That just means so much. So with that said, you wrote a book. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, sure. So I co-authored a book that was published by Brooks in the fall of last year. It's called Empowering Students with Hidden Disabilities, A Path to Pride and Success. And so I co-authored with a lady named Margot Izzo, and I think it's important. I don't know if it was said in my introduction or if I've said it yet, but I have a learning disability and went through from third grade all the way until graduating from high school in special education on an IEP, receiving special education support. And I am a part of the first generation of young people to pass through what we now refer to as special ed. And so the system that I experienced was less than ideal and left me with a lot of sort of social emotional scars. I was able to pull myself through that, and I had great parents, and then you know, some really great teachers and counselors that guided me towards Middlesex County College here in Central New Jersey, because there they have a really excellent you know, Class A support program for students with learning disabilities. And so it was in there that I discovered I had all these talents. I really understood how my mind worked. I started using the appropriate supports and really blossomed as a student. And so, yeah, I realized I could write. I realized that I was really gifted at math, you know, and you know, became the person that I am today. And so I... after graduating, you know, I began sort of sharing my story with young people, with educational professionals, with policymakers all over the United States and a little bit internationally. And in part of my travels, I was asked to do a presentation in Washington, D.C. For the Federal Department of Education, and ran into a lady named Margot Izzo. And Margot's a researcher, a project director at The Ohio State University. And from that meeting, Margot brought me on the campus a few times, and we became not only colleagues but also friends. And she let me know that she had a daughter with ADHD, and through helping her daughter advocate you know, understand what her needs were, Margot identified that she actually had ADHD herself. And so she was at this point already professional, already had her PhD, and so was just sort of, I guess, coming to terms with this new sort of aspect of who she was. And so after knowing each other for a little while, we decided that we thought that, you know, it would be a good idea for us to write down some of our experiences, as well as sharing some of our professional knowledge as to what the best practices were in the field of special education and providing supports for folks with disabilities. And so the book is was, you know, as of last year, it was my major project. It took about 3 years to write. And it's about 50% narrative, where Margo and I share our own personal stories, and then Margo talks a lot about what it was like being a parent of a child with a disability. But we also interviewed a number of young adults with a variety of different disabilities, and use that narrative to really back up the research that we were able to do, centered around transition. And so, you know, what is needed to help young people with disabilities to graduate from high school, go on to you know, independent living, higher education, and careers, or whatever their long-term goals are. And so that's the book, and it has been utilized at universities as a textbook. It was written with a primary focus on educators, both in service and pre-service. But it's also, I think, been a very powerful tool for families to use, as well as individuals with disabilities themselves. And we have this focus on hidden disabilities. And so through our research, we found that somewhere between 55% and 85% of the students in special education could be considered to have some kind of hidden disability. And that's just a person that does not have a very obvious sort of socially understood indicator that says, hey, I have a disability, like maybe walking with an impaired gait or using a wheelchair or something along those lines. And what we argue in the book is that with that hidden disability, there's an extra layer of challenge, because those young people who can hide, who do have a hidden disability, oftentimes choose to hide, and will not focus on what their disability is, will not seek support, and oftentimes it's to their detriment. And so the book, its main focus is on transition, but we also talk quite a bit about the importance of helping young people with hidden disabilities to develop a positive disability identity, to think of disability as a positive identifier, and to get to the point where they eventually, you know, consider they're proud of how their minds and their bodies work. I know that was a big part of my journey, to not only sort of come to terms with who I am and how my mind works, but also to be very, very proud of it, to also realize that, you know, as part of being a person with a learning disability or learning difference, or having attention issues, I'm also a part of a very large community of people who throughout history have done a lot to give back to the larger society. So that's the book, and we're very proud of it. And you know, I think one of the biggest compliments that any artist can get is, or really any person in general can get, is to get, you know, praise from the people who you really respect. And so quite a few of the heavy hitters in the world of transition and disability have read the book and reached back out to us and given it really, real high praise. And so we're very proud of what we've created, and even more proud of the difference it's making in people's lives.
You know, if we could just delve a little deeper into this segment of disabilities. That's a very profound point that you made. When we think disabilities, we think, like you said, walking with a gait or, you know, having some physical impairment. But the other side of that, and I don't know, you know, what that percentage is, and maybe you can give us an idea of those who have the non-visible disabilities versus visible disabilities. You know, is it a, you know, 50-50? And when I talk about non-visible, of course, you being the professional in the area, those things like an ADHD and mm-hmm. and and those types of things. So there's a whole world of individuals who have challenges that the average person doesn't even see. So I would suspect, with that said, unless it's brought to the attention of the masses, society at large is significantly even unaware of the importance, so it's not given the attention and therefore resources perhaps that it even deserves.
Yeah. So we looked at the most recent research from the Department of Education, and the statistic, the sort of range that we came up with was between 55% and 85% of the special education population can be considered as having some kind of hidden disability. And the reason why it's a range is because for many disability categories, they exist on a spectrum, right? And in some cases, you know, so like autism, we talk about autism as being on a spectrum all the time. So for some people on the autism spectrum, you can there are like visual cues to kind of say, hey, you know, this person maybe has a disability. But for other people who are also on the spectrum, it may not be as obvious. The same thing is true for hearing, having issues with your hearing, or visual impairment. There's a sort of range, right? But I think ultimately we'll never really know, right? Because it is a hidden population. There are probably a large number of people who never get identified at all, you know, and we'll never really have an exact count of who those folks are. And I do presentations all the time, oftentimes to educators or business leaders, and there are people that will come up afterwards, and you know, and particularly if they're, you know, kind of up there in age, they'll say, hey, you know, they never really had any kind of classes like that when I was in school, but, you know, I've always known that I had something going on, right? And they may not be able to put a finger on it, but they're also clear, like, you know, I've had to work hard to get through school, or maybe school wasn't even for me, you know, and so they came up with their own path and their own coping mechanisms and their own supports and their own system of support that allowed them to be successful. But it's a very broad sort of spectrum of people. But we thought it was important to highlight that population, because so often there is a lot of shame, there's a lot of embarrassment, because we quote unquote look normal, right? And so everyone sort of expects us to be able to do what everybody else can do. Also last year I got to be a part of a really good documentary, and your listeners may want to check it out. It's available online. It was originally published on PBS, and it's a part of the PBS series, Road Trip Nation. And what Road Trip Nation did, it's part of Road Trip Nation.
Road Trip Nation?
Yeah, and the documentary is called Being You.
Being You, B-E-I-N-G?
Yep, Y-O-U.
Being You.
And it's available for free. You can check it out online. And in that documentary, it's the journey of three young people with learning and attention issues. And they get in a RV and they drive out from, I believe, California all the way across the United States. And they eventually make it into New York and then up into Providence, Rhode Island. And throughout their journey, they meet a number of different people who are artists and CEOs and celebrities with learning and attention issues. And these young people are at a point in their lives where they're really at a transition and trying to figure out, you know, one's in high school. I think the other two have graduated from college, but are just trying to figure out what their next steps are. And more than anything, trying to figure out who they are and, you know, how they kind of fit into the larger context of everybody else around them, particularly with having these diagnoses. And so it's a real moving portrayal of that journey and that transition stage. But early on in the documentary, maybe around the halfway point, there's an interview with a guy named Peter Damon. And Pete is a user interface designer, and his claim to fame is that he developed the user interface that Stephen Hawking, the theoretical physicist, uses to write and to interact with the rest of the world. And Pete was born with a learning disability, and when he was a young man, he had an accident that led him to having to use a wheelchair. And so he tells a really great story in the documentary where he says that he would roll into his college classroom, and everyone would immediately take a look at him and see him in the wheelchair and kind of figure out, hey, you know, there's something going on with Pete. And, you know, in your mind, you start thinking about, well, what kind of help can I provide? What kind of support is that and the other? But throughout his time in college, Pete never really told anybody that he also had, you know, dyslexia, had a learning disability. And so he's got this great quote where he says, there's no wheelchair for dyslexia. You know, there's no visual cue to kind of let the rest of the world know that you need help and what that help might be like. And the reason why I like to quote Pete is because, you know, I think what that quote about there being no wheelchair for dyslexia, what it really says is that the onus is on the individual, right, to kind of open their mouth and to say, particularly as you make that transition into the adult world, if you want any services, if you want any support, if you want any kind of help, you have to in some way, you know, stand up or put your hand up and open your mouth and say, hey, I need support. And that takes a lot of self-knowledge, a lot of self-awareness, and a lot of strength, as well as, you know, for many of us, a lot of training to be able to do that effectively. And so, you know, that again is part of why, you know, why we worked on and put out this book, is because if you want a young person with really with any kind of disability, but particularly for a hidden disability, to be effective in the adult world, they've got to get comfortable with being able to say, hey, I need some help. And then they also have to have the knowledge to be able to know what that help is going to look like in a variety of situations.
Wow. Yeah. We'll have to make mention of that later on in the program and in future programs. It was part of Round Trip Nation, you said? A series?
Road, like to travel on the road, Road Trip Nation?
Road Trip Nation, okay. Trip Nation. And this was called Being You.
Being You, yeah.
Three people traveling cross country. You know, you brought to mind when I was listening to you talk about some of those hidden disabilities like dyslexia and ADHD and things like that. But I thought about, you know, things like anxiety disorder and depression. Now, is there an overlap, or is that considered a hidden disability? Is there an overlap between what might be considered a disorder, or are those one and the same, or a disability? Like depression, is that considered a disability, or is that something so acute it's more like a disorder? Is there a differentiator?
So in special education, there's a very large category of emotional disabilities, and much of what you've mentioned there would fall within that category. But I think there's also a distinct field, you know, the mental health world. And I think what's actually very interesting is I think there is a whole lot of overlap. Oftentimes, people with disabilities, some of their biggest challenges are actually not associated with their disability. For many of us, it is the trauma and much of the mental health challenges that come about from being, you know, different and being treated different, and oftentimes being growing up and feeling as if you are less than. And so I know myself, I've battled throughout my life with depression and the anxiety to a certain extent, you know, and different fears. And it's taken a lot of work, you know, and continued work to get to the point where, you know, I don't let that stuff control me, you know, but seek out the supports I need to be able to keep moving. But there is a lot of, you know, the sort of technical word would be comorbidity between the different categories.
Okay, I see. So, yeah, one could be even a byproduct of the other, as you were
right.
just explaining. Wow. Oh. something else that I found interesting in listening to what you were saying about the different hidden disabilities. People don't think about, you know, hearing, visual. I know of those who have visual impairments,
mm-hmm.
Derek, and
yes.
They're not 100% impaired, and yet they're disabled because
yes.
They have a significant impairment. And so the same with hearing. It is a disability, even though it may not be, you may not be, you know, totally deaf.
Right.
So there are those I'm concerned with as you live your specialty, that perhaps go through life, you know, myself, maybe notwithstanding, with a disability. And,
yeah.
And take it as, well, either I can deal with this, it's just that my sight isn't as good as others, or my hearing isn't as good as others, or I don't remember as well as the next person. But I think you even used that as an example in one of your statements. But in effect, we probably need help, and there may
yeah.
be help to be given. So again, back to that awareness factor, that this is, you know, one of these societal issues that's maybe significantly under the radar and doesn't get the attention it really needs.
Yeah, you know, human beings are so diverse, and we are so complex. And I consider him to be a mentor, a guy named Dr. William Henderson. And Dr. Henderson wrote a really good book called The Blind Advantage, where he talks about his experience as a person with a visual impairment. He's a school administrator for a number of years and ran a elementary school up in the Boston area called the Patrick O'Haron School. And I made frequent pilgrimages up there because they were really a best practice example for what inclusion could be. So, you know, building a school, building out classrooms where people with and without disabilities were educated together, and everybody got the support and were challenged in ways that allowed them to grow, you know, to their own level. And it was a blue ribbon school. I mean, there, you know, I heard words that, you know, there were like senators that were sending their kids there. And his work was so successful that they were able to build out that culture and that model out. So now I believe it's pre-K through 12. And when he retired, they actually named the school after him. So it's now the William Henderson School. And in one of my visits up there, him and I were walking, and because he's a big exercise fan, and so we were out walking one morning before school, and he said to me, he said, you know, Derek, you can think of human ability, all abilities, as being a spectrum, right, existing on a spectrum. And so his example was for visual impairments. He said, you know, if you think about visual impairment, on one end, there are people who are blind, right? And there are actually, you know, relatively few people who are totally blind. And on the other end of that spectrum is a class of people who we, as a society, don't think about as being people with disabilities, but they are to a certain extent. And that's people who wear glasses, right? So if you wear glasses, you don't have 20/20 vision. You've got some degree of a visual impairment. And the glasses piece is really interesting to me, because what has happened as a society is that there's a piece of adaptive technology that we created to help people on that end of the visual impairment spectrum, and they're glasses. You know, we think of them as being relatively mundane now because they're everywhere and they're readily available for most people. But they say serve the same purpose for many people that a wheelchair will, if you need to use a wheelchair. Or for me, would be the equivalent of like spell checker, because spelling is such a big issue for me, or having all my books in an audio format. I think it hints to the way that we find help, and maybe even the potential that we have as a larger society to be able to provide that help and to have it seem seamless and not as odd or out of place, but just something we provide for people because they need it.
Wow, that's profound, because it does, it makes the disability much more acceptable, you know, just to be frank about it, and therefore
yeah.
there's less anxiety for the individual with the disability, and everyone
yeah.
comes out ahead. Back
right.
to that notion of the attention being, you know, given and the resources that's needed in this area.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting because even like, you know, we've reached a point where designers build glasses, create and design glasses, right? I mean, it's something that can be, you know, very expensive. And I think Tommy Hilfiger last year announced that he was developing a line of braces to go on people's legs that were going to be fashionable, you know. I'm an iPhone user. You know, there are accessibility features built into most of Apple's devices, and you would really look at just about all of the, particularly the mobile tech, that are, you know, seamlessly sort of designed to help people with disabilities. And most folks aren't aware of it. Most people don't turn it on, but it's there. And, you know, yeah, like there's an accessibility feature you can turn on the iPhone, and the iPhone will start reading out loud everything that's on your screen. And so, yeah, the idea is that, you know, disability, one way you can think about disability is that what disability is that, you know, it's what happens when society encounters people that they aren't really prepared for, right? And so, you know, our devices, our architecture, our systems aren't designed to be able to provide supports for them. And so, you know, part of the work that I want to be able to do over the course of my life is to be able to create a society where, you know, we're prepared for and ready to support, you know, human beings for all their diversity.
If we could only be colorblind. you know, and gender blind. And when you come up with that one, my brother,
yeah,
you know, whoa, right?
Right.
The pill that that eliminates the prejudices. And anyway, that's a blue sky. That's, I thought I have to throw that one in for a smile.
Right.
But you never know. What the mind can conceive.
Yep.
You know, but this is a beautiful work that you have delved into. It's a wonderful thing. And yet you still have your passion for, you know, humanity and those that are, you know less advantaged, let's say. And that was part of the individual that I met, as you said. I was not wanting to date myself, but it's been more than 15 years. You're so true. Quite a few, more than a couple decades.
Yeah.
Which takes me to one of the other ventures, your play that you co-created, the New Street Poets.
Yeah, New Street Poets.
Tell me a little bit about that.
That was New Street Poets came about through an opportunity I had connected to Crossroads Theater in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan Suttle, who's on the board, I believe still serves on the board today,
mm-hmm.
approached me. She got a copy of my first album, which is Rhyme, Reason, and Song. And she said, you know, Derek, I'd really like to give you an opportunity to create something here for the theater and sort of bring in young people. And New Brunswick is, you know, it's the hub city, you know, and I grew up in Somerset just to the south. And I like to say that I was born twice in New Brunswick. First, at St. Peter's Hospital, you know, literal birth, and then also born as a poet because my first open mic, first time I ever read a poem, was on New Street at a small place called Affairs of the Palette Palette, which was a cafe and an art gallery. And first open mic that I helped to run was there, and we used to just pack it in, man. It was like so many people, standing room only when we would do those shows, and a wonderful mix of the New Brunswick community. So we would get, you know, the college students from Rutgers and folks like me from the county colleges, and you know, we'd also get people who were, you know, high school kids, and you know, folks in rehab, you know, who would just come out of a meeting, and you know, like everybody would come in and they would share their work and share their experiences. And the place got knocked down. It was taken by eminent domain and is now, you know, a 21st century parking deck. And so when I got asked to create this show, you know, in New Brunswick, right across the street from where this, you know, which to me was like a holy ground was, I said, well, you know, I want to use the opportunity to sort of tell the story of this community and how this community is changing. And you know, all the efforts to knock down the project and move out the poor people and get people of a higher demographic, you know, particularly financially, to be able to move in. So yeah, New Street was born from that, and I worked with a group of other spoken word poets, and we sort of workshopped it at Crossroads, and then did a second iteration of it and introduced that to the International Friends Festival. And we were told that, I think out of 180 plays that were part of the festival that year, our play was ranked in the top 10. We got very, very high reviews, and once the first review came out, we had a sold-out run, and we then took it on the road and performed it at another number of other locations. But it's a spoken word play, 2-hour, 2-act play that really looked at the effects of gentrification on downtown communities of artists, and it tells the story of a group of poets who have a cafe, and the cafe is threatened through eminent domain, and the first act is just all the different ways in which they try to fight losing their poetic home. And then the second act is the sort of side effect of what happens when that place they love is lost. And we made a special effort to try to, you know, dig deeper than the headlines and really try to tell some of the stories of people who all over the country, and I guess really all over the world, you know, are fighting to try to save their homes. And it was interesting because, you know, it was kind of written for a northeastern, you know, slightly more urban community. But one of the folks who saw it was a young lady from Ohio, and she was saying how she really connected to it because where she's from, developers are coming in and they're buying up these beautiful old farms and cutting them up and turning them into subdivisions, which is, you know, which is another side of this. So yeah, it's you know, just a piece of art that you know, tries to tell that story of people fighting for their communities. And we try not to, like, you know, glorify poverty or glorify, you know, like rundown communities or places that need revitalization, because, you know, there's a tremendous need for that. But we're very clear that what makes a community is not the buildings, but it's the people. And so when you get to a point where redevelopment is actually cutting out the heart or the soul of a community, a city, a neighborhood, there's just something wrong with that. And so that's what the play wrestles with.
Yeah, you know, that's that regentrification is a very pressing issue in these last 10 or 15 years, actually. And so you were actually ahead of your time, because as you, I'm sure, are aware of, that's one of the issues facing this country now. In urban and rural areas, where, as you said, that middle class and lower middle class is being displaced for, and this is the negativity of it, because it's not necessarily a negativity, because when you have you know, slum, not ghetto,
yeah,
slum,
yeah,
difference.
Yeah.
You know, you want to revitalize, but revitalization does not necessarily mean replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the negative side that I see of that regentrification or gentrification, is that folks are being, you know,
not just replaced, but displaced. And so what's your thought on that? Not to go political, but in this trend that's going on.
We wrestled with a few things, and one of the things that we dealt with was actually the artist's role in gentrification. You know, one of the things that developers look for when they decide to come in and start buying a property is whether the artists are there. You know, like it's a draw. You know, young urban professionals oftentimes like to be around places with the cool bookstore or the cool coffee shop. You know, and so we wrestled with, you know, what our role was, being able to actually, you know, sort of being the point of the spear as these folks were coming in. I believe that we have to be able to create space for everybody, right? And so, you know, a combination of affordable housing, And I honestly believe that you know that people want that mix. You know, I know that our communities, our schools, our nation is better when diverse people are talking to each other and are interacting with each other. And I think unfortunately that's becoming less and less of the norm. I was listening to the radio last night, and they were talking about, I guess, the past presidential election, and looking at different counties, and how, you know, there are more and more of these sort of landslide counties that are occurring, you know, where people are increasingly voting more Democrat and increasingly voting more Republican. And what's really happening is that, you know, people are moving. You know, they're choosing to be closer to people who think like them and act like them, and in some cases even look like them, and I think that, you know, that we're lesser for that. You know, it's you know, it's really problematic if you don't know what the other side is thinking. You know what I mean? And so, you know, being able to, you know, have spaces where we can all interact, I think is really, really important.
Yeah, I would agree. That's that diversity, you know, piece. I guess the concern that I have again is that there will always be, you know, scenarios where those of a certain echelon, you know, don't have a desire to be around those who are not. And to some extent, I'm not one to try to. Well, I'm an advocate for those who are less less fortunate, of a lower income, so I don't want this statement to be misinterpreted at all. But to an extent, I can reason with that, because with a lower income comes a higher crime rate, and so then you have to deal with that, and so it gets to be probably deeper than what we want to go into now, but. That cookie cutter approach, I do believe there's a better approach than that, to just you know, student body left mass upheaval. With that said, just to delve just a bit in terms of where you stand with regard to, you know, the societal landscape, what's your take on where we are as a society versus, say, 20 or 30 years ago? Are we heading in the right direction? Or if not, is it at a slower pace than it was 10 years ago that we're heading in this direction that is not as fruitful for us as a society? How does that impact those at the lower rungs, which are typically Black and Latino? What's your thought? How are we doing? What's your report card look like?
I think, in terms of assessing, you know, particularly in the disability world, I feel as if we are moving in the right direction, right? particularly when I can look back at what my experiences were like passing through school. I think there's much more awareness. There are many more programs. There's much more support. But with that said, I can also tell you that I visit many communities, whether they be inner cities or in more rural areas, and you would think that, you know, like nothing has changed, right? And so I think sort of the, you know, the unfortunate reality of America is that there are these pockets, you know, these sort of pockets where people are able to get the support and the resources that they need to be able to move forward. And then at the same time, there are, you know, some areas where, you know, it's very wanting. I would, you know, as you were asking the question, one of the things that came to mind to me was a conversation I had with Brother Bill Davis, and he was saying how this is during Barack Obama's tenure as president, how, you know, part of what it is to be in America now, particularly, you know, to be black and in America, is that at the same time that you've got, you know, a person of color, you know, black family in the White House, you have all these mass police shootings, you know. And so it feels as if, you know, we've like reached this high height at the same time when we're, you know, quite literally being a target for violence, you know. If I had to give it a report card, I'd say the report card was mixed, you know. And that what that means is that, you know, there's still a increased earnest for us as individuals to keep pushing forward. Because I firmly believe that whether it be politicians or any kind of policy, that stuff only changes if people raise their voices and if they're informed and if they push an agenda forward. There are no politicians that just wake up and then say, hey, you know, I want to make the world necessarily a better place. I mean, oftentimes it is because the masses are saying this is an issue which we find important. This is something that we want our resources to be spent on. This is a change we want to create. And I think that, you know, that when you talk about, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, the landscape has changed, particularly as far as the way in which we receive information. I was talking to my father today, and I said, you know, Dad, I'm going to do a radio interview this evening. And he said, AM or FM? I was like, well, no, not really. You know, it's going to be online. And, you know, and I think back to when I was a kid, you know, there was everybody, if you were listening to the radio, we were all basically listening to the same handful of stations. And we were having a very similar cultural experience. I think the same thing is true with the news. You know, we now live at a time where not only do we have a 24/7 news cycle, but you've got, I don't know, hundreds of channels to pick from to determine. And by that, I don't only mean like TV stations, but just, you know, the internet or what have you, to be able to experience the take on news that you want. And so I think it makes it a bit difficult, or not even a bit, it makes it very difficult for us to have a common dialogue and to see common problems, because oftentimes we're not always seeing the same things. And I can tell you that's one of the things that I find increasingly challenging with trying to have a conversation, particularly about something like race or class, is there are some people who just don't have the language. I mean, just have not, you know, not even taken the time to be able to understand some of the issues. And that's not true for all folks, but it can be challenging. You know?
Yeah, it's something for everyone. You can go to MSNBC if you have a certain mindset, and you can go to Fox if you have another. And so you're very and it's so polarized now. And that's, you know, that's why I and to many perspectives, you know, to the dismay, I try not to gravitate either way.
Yeah.
Because, and this is simply my perspective, not trying to impose it, which I never do week in and week out, but at some point during the discourse, it usually does come up, because I try to go beyond whatever the topic is, whether it's technology or the environment or culture
or the arts, to bring it down to a more you know, base conversation, which is the humanity of it all, which threads all of that. And
yeah.
So typically it does arise, and so, you know, my perspective is I try not to do the political thing, because, and this is where, you know, by some standards folks really can get irritated. What do you dare say something bad about the Democrats, Darryl?
Right.
We have those, and the lines are open. By the way, folks, hopefully, you know, Mr. Horn, my friend Derek will join us again. We're running out of time, so we won't be able to take callers. And I see you out there; you're tuned in. And but I wanted to just say that I just don't subscribe to that. And with all that's available, we have to be very, very careful with what's on the surface. And so by that same token, someone would say, Darryl, I can't believe you said something positive against the for the Republicans. I can't believe that you're supposed to be this. And I'm like, you know, that's like white men can't jump. You know,
right.
don't put me in that box, and I'm not going to be there. And and I'm just encouraging people to just open their minds up, especially with the political arena that we're in now. It's first of all, it's really at the end of the day, when that rocket ship takes off because Earth is in trouble, it's not going to be about Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah.
It's going to be what connections do you have? What kind of money do you have? Trump will be sitting right next to Obama. And you can say, no. Okay, so he'll be on one side of the ship and the other will be on the other side of the ship. But they're both going to be there. So,
yeah.
And if you don't believe that, let's look at this confrontation with the Russians. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of us know that the space program with regard to the shuttle program was ceased many, many years ago. So now when and there is a space station out there, folks, whether you believe it or not, and it's manned internationally. And the primary mode of getting there is coming from Russian soil. Get over it. Do the research. That's how we're getting there. So now we're having a conflict with the Russians. So what do you think is going to happen? They're going to say, well, we're not taking you there anymore. So at the end of the day, you got to really start putting on the thinking cap and saying, wait a minute now. Are these, they call it saber rattling?
Mm.
I mean, what's happening really behind the scenes? So don't be misled by what you're being fed, I tell, you know, the listeners from my perspective, because you really don't know. You know, I'm of the Dick Gregory mindset to an extent, a friend and mentor. I'm proud to say that. And I, whenever I can, we talk. He's on the road now, and he'll be back, I'm hoping. I talk with Miss Gregory a few days ago, but I'm of that. I'm of that mentorship that don't believe everything you see, and then if you see it and it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's probably a duck.
Right.
So we've got to, like you're saying, Brother Lederick, you know, we've got to use our own senses to sort through this,
because
it stands now, folks are buying. Go ahead.
And that's the power of the arts, you know, is to kind of give us the ability to look past that surface, you know. And I was just talking to a young lady. We were talking about the sort of the absence and the way that our arts programs have been removed from our schools, and you know, I can tell you. From the training I have, one of the most powerful things that you receive as an artist is the ability to see, you know, to be able to look beyond just the surface, to really look at detail and to be able to analyze what's in front of you. You know, in kind of looping this back to the beginning of our conversation, and, you know, in the mm-hmm. sort of the, when there used to be this absolute desire for artists to be able to make political statements, and how some of that is lacking. You know, one of the albums I've been playing recently is the latest album from a tribe called Quest, and they've got, it's interesting, you were talking about that spaceship. Their first track is all about, going to Mars and people going to Mars, and it ends up that, yeah, it's this larger metaphor for, gentrification, and the way that, those lines are being drawn. And, it's not just hyperbole. I mean, like, that's the next push, the United States has ditched the shuttle program, and it's no longer looking for Russia. It's SpaceX, and Musk has got the contract to try to put people up there on the International Space Station, and his push is to try to build a sustainable city on Mars. And it's really, it's this next wave of colonization, and he's talking about it being a lot closer than we all maybe think. And, who's going to be able to afford that ticket? It's sort of the next wave, and it's, the ultimate sort of have and have not division.
Couple of things as we approach the top of the hour and running out of time. Number one, Derek, would you come back sometime in the not distant future if you're not traveling too much? Because you have to offer beyond your gifts, which is your gift of humanitarianism, your gift of knowledge and intellect and acumen for that which you have made a determination to put your lifetime into, which is that to serve those with disabilities. And your gift of the spoken word, which takes me to my second question, but I you have so much to offer other than those things in terms of just your pure insightful sense and wisdom, and I think that the dialogue that you bring thereof is one that I'd like to give the listeners an opportunity, and they know me from knowing now that, okay, Darryl, you didn't give us a chance to talk, so I know Mr. Horn's coming back soon, and that's how I roll. This is a medium that I believe we need to utilize. I was listening to, in fact, earlier today on YouTube, an interview with a discussion around media and how important it is, and how it has changed, and that it is a part of the social fabric, and we have to be very careful that we're not pigeonholed into one type of a media outlet or another. Example: CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and the like. So, this forum is just for that. It's an open forum. All opinions and perspectives are welcome. And what you bring is most valuable. So that's a long way to say I really, when I reach out to you, and I will be reaching out in the next couple of days, I really would appreciate it if you, consider your timetable and be willing to not let it be, 2 months or 3 months, because you have so much to offer thereof. Now, the next thing that I wanted to ask, and you haven't answered the first one yet, but the next thing is I want to ask if, before we close out at the top of the hour, if you'd be willing to just whatever moves you or grooves you right now in terms of your energy and spirit, share with us one of your spoken words, something that would be apropos for this time that we're in, of the year, of the week, of the season, of society. If you'd be willing to do that. So those are my two questions for you, and then I would ask, lastly, before you close, of course, share your reach information if someone's desiring, which they always are, for our guests to reach out. That's three things.
Yes.
That's my three-part question.
I was really looking forward to taking some calls, and so, I think we ran a little bit longer than anticipated tonight.
I did.
Yeah, and I appreciate this channel and the opportunity to be able to converse with you and to share what's on both of our minds with your audience. And so I look forward to an opportunity to be able to join again in the not too distant future. So that's the first one. And then as far as poetry goes, I'll do a relatively short poem.
All right.
And it's timely. It's called An American Idea, and I'm sure many of your listeners were paying attention to the DeVos hearings as she was appointed as the head of the Department of Education as part of the new administration. And there was quite a bit of dialogue within within my community about her reference to IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disability Education Act, which is the law that the federal law, civil rights law that creates and governs and oversees special education. And I had the pleasure, as we were celebrating the 35th anniversary of that law, to narrate a short documentary about the history of special education. And it's up on YouTube, and if you search celebrating 35th anniversary IDEA, it'll come up. And it's a really well done film. And you'll hear me narrating it. And at the end of it, I do this poem, which is called An American Idea. And it also appears on my second album, which is called Black and Blue. So this is it, An American Idea. It's an American idea. Today's child will be tomorrow's citizen. Education shapes our expression of liberty. And separate, well, that has never been equal. We are the students of a new day. Brave scholars who claim desk and classroom, book and school, until the self-evident truths expressed through our victories gave this nation's first declaration renewed life. Each mind is beautiful. Strength has many forms, and we are all able. Thank you.
Wow.
Whew. Short and sweet. You weren't kidding. that's just a straight out the park hit. Wow. I need to know exactly what you mentioned where we can get that on YouTube, because we're YouTube listeners here on Progressive News. So celebrating 25th.
So celebrating 35th anniversary IDEA.
IDEA. Celebrating 35th anniversary.
Yeah, and if your listeners just put my name into YouTube, Lederick Horn, and it's LEDERICK and HORNE. I have a channel, and it's got a bunch of clips of me performing and doing presentations and workshops and things along those lines. And that video is also up on Facebook, and so. And I'm very active on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram as well. But if folks want to reach out to me directly, if it's not through like the social media channels, you can go to my website, which is just lederick.com. So again, LEDERICK.com. And there's a sign-up sheet for a newsletter there, as well as you can shoot me an email. And the site is in need of being updated, and we're working on that right now. But all the forms still work, and again, there's more information about me there.
Fantastic. Well, that's the Reach information. If you joined us late, you have to catch the archives. We kept it live. We kept it real. Mr. Lederick Horn, well, renowned artist of the spoken word, one who truly uses his talents and gifts for benevolent purposes and making a difference with those who are disabled and disenfranchised, a true humanitarian. Again, catch the archives at blogtalkradio.com/Renford, R-E-N-F-O-R-D. Search for Daryl Clark's Progressive News Weekly, and you can hear the entire extended interview with Mr. Lederick Horn. And of course, as he mentioned, you can catch him on YouTube, you can catch him on Facebook, and his site is lederick.com. Lederick Horn, I am truly, as you know, going to be reaching out. I know my phone's going to bust off. Mr. Daryl, you did it again. You didn't let the guests talk with us, but I'm going to promise them that you will be back, and we're going to open up taking dialogue with the listeners, because I know that that's one that you truly enjoy, is interfacing with the listeners. And I had quite a few
that had mentioned they were looking forward to this interview, but you just had so much to share, and we truly appreciate that. To all of our listeners, we thank you for tuning in to another edition of Progressive News Weekly. Until the next time, I just believe love will bring us back together. And so with that said, enjoy your holiday weekends. Lederick, let's touch base the next day after the show or so if we can connect and make this thing happen again. Thanks again, my brother. This was truly
excellent.
Thank you,
brother. Appreciate it. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.